Next Chapter Podcasts.
Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in business into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
J.A.M. been walking us down through that 2012 edition, so it ain't nothing too new. Hundreds more to go and in need of a friend, the king of fleas for Angelo, talking the 500 until the end. Talking the 500 until the end. With my man J.A.M. on the 500, talking the 500 until the end.
Welcome to the podcast, Scootaloo. Nigel Roe Blues by Moby from the 1999 album Play. It's number 341 out of 500 on this podcast called The 100.
That's pretty good. Dude, I remember when that came out, man. That swept the vegan community. Moby Moby, who is a Toby? How's everybody doing? I'm good. I've got some stuff to tell you about. I will be in Edmonton, Canada at the House of Comedy December 9th through the 9th, and either the 13th, that Thursday through Sunday. And then the next week, I will be at the St. Louis Funny Bone. But it's not at St. Louis, but it's the one close to it. It's in St. Louis. It's a Funny Bone. December 20th, I will be doing the goddamn Comedy Jam at the Comedy Cellar. And New Year's Eve. And that weekend, I will be in Vancouver at the House of Comedy. Come all out. Come all out. Come all out. Tickets for all those shows. I want to see all the Fleece Army out there, man. Go to my website for tickets, joshadammyers.com. Follow me at Josh Adam Myers on all social media. And support the podcast at patreon.com/the500podcast. We need your money. If you're a Patreon, we will read your comments about each album on the podcast episode with the guest. Questions for the guest. You get to ask. You get to be a part of it. $5 or more. $5 or more. Zamora. $5 Zamora a month. Join it. Moby, Moby, Moby. This is a record that I was not looking forward to. I like a couple songs off of it. But it's on the list. And you must respect the list. My guest today though you know his work. If you follow me on social media or you follow the 500 on Instagram or any of the social media platforms, you know my good buddy Young and Sick, a.k.a. Nick Von Hefwegen. Nick has created art for Foster the People, Maroon 5, Robin Thicke, T. Mills, Andy Dick, Jerry Stiller. In 2014, BBC Radio 1 called Young and Sick the next hype, and the project was named Stereo Gum's Band to Watch. I have his art hanging up in my apartment. He is my buddy. He is so talented on so many levels. He does all the artwork for the 500, and this guy is an incredible artist, musician, and person. He's a dear friend of mine, and I wanted him on the podcast because I just wanted to have fun with him. I just wanted to have fun with a buddy. So he sat down and we talked Moby. This was an incredibly fun conversation because Nick knows his shit. So enjoy this. Rate, review, and subscribe to the 500. Leave us a review on Apple or any of the other places. Follow me at Josh Adam Myers on all social media. Go to joshadammyers.com for all tickets. Email the podcast at 500podcast@gmail.com. Follow the Facebook group run by Crazy Evan. And for all things 500, go to the500podcast.com. Well, nothing left to say, but here we go with 341. Moby's play Scootily-Doo. I think, Nick, yes. I think you might be our first guest that, can I say it?
Say it, what?
That has COVID as we're doing
this. You can say it. I texted negative yesterday, finally.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry to break it. I should have yes ended and told you. I
took off the ventilator for this.
I smoked my first weed today.
Good. You deserve it. So I love how we met. We met to everybody. We really met online. We matched on Raya. And immediately I was drawn to your art. Immediately I was drawn to everything about you, man. I think you're one of the most talented artists working today. What do you have going on right now? So tell us everything, because you're really killing it in the NFTs, right?
That's what I'm mostly doing right now. I only have one client, and it's the 500.
huge client, dude. Huge
project. I've always been making art mostly for bands, and then this NFT thing rolled around that kind of was made for me in a way. So I kind of started doing that only at that point when it started kind of blowing up a little bit.
But I mean, this is something that is the thing right now, and this is something that you're like really, really doing well with. I mean, it's almost like your art was made for NFTs. When I see what people 100%. Are selling, I'm like, oh my God, like Young and Sick, Nick, you have like, it's just everything about it. Like the music I've listened to that you've made, the art that I've seen you make, even just the clothing that you wear is very interesting and it's cool.
I usually look like a bag of Skittles for sure.
That is the perfect description of you. You are a walking Skittles commercial. All right. So you're kind of like a Renaissance man. So besides art, you make music, you know, and when we were talking on that walk, me and you were hanging out, and we were talking about stuff, and I was like, yo, I want to get you on, man. And I was like, what would you do? And you said Moby Play. Which, how old are you, by the way?
33.
You're 33. Okay, yeah. So this came out in
99, I believe.
Adam? 99, yeah, 1999. Mm. So you at that time are what?
I'm trying to think.
12, 13 years old. I'm terrible. 13, I'd say. I think you're 13 years old. So go ahead and tell me like the first time you heard this record.
So I looked up the list of like sort of big records that came out in 1999. And I was very much in my sort of like, when the kid in Sopranos, like it's really into metal, like he gets really into new metal in the show. Like that was that was what I was listening to. I was listening to a lot of like Korn, Slipknot, shit like that. As a 13-year-old, I was just a little Dutch kid in a small town. And so most of the music I was listening to was just very loud, abrasive, sort of new metal. And certain electronic records started sort of showing up at friends' houses. Like I heard this record for the first time because I was in a little band. Like we were terrible, absolutely awful band. I was 13 years old. And my friend, the bass player, he had an older sister. I think she was probably like 3 years older than me.
Yeah.
And if I had sleepovers at his house when we would just play like Nintendo 64, in the middle of the night, she usually just like came, like yank me out of the room and take me to her room. And like, we would just like listen to albums and make out. And,
wow.
And she would just introduce me to like weird, interesting stuff. And so the first time I heard the Moby record was just like in a bedroom of my friend's sister.
Wow. This is, you know what?
It's a good way to get introduced to it.
No, 100%. Oh my God. Like the album Coldplay XY, even though I heard it before mm-hmm. I had sex to it, I had this one girl in Baltimore who was visiting from Alabama that I had met at a bar. And then like 2 months later, she's hit me up and she was like, we never hooked up that time. I just hit on her. And then she hit me up and she's like, hey, I'm in town. Do you want to come hang out in my hotel room? And I was like, oh my God, like, am I just about to get laid? And then we go and she makes me, she's like, do you have condoms? I was like, what? Oh my, what? And then we go back to the hotel room and she's like, let's put some music on. And she put on XY. Then when we like fuck to that record. And now anytime I hear it, it's like I immediately
right.
That incredible night. So what a great way to listen to this record. Also playing Nintendo 64 to this. I mean, if there ever was a record that is made for playing video games too, I think this could really, really be in the top three.
It would be great. But instead of that, we were playing Mario Kart and listening to Primus at the same time. So,
dude,
it also works. But
dude, when we used to play Mario Kart when I was away in school, we listened to the Hail to the Thief by Radiohead.
Oh,
and that was great. Like another record that it was like perfect for that video game. Mm-hmm. There's something about this, like turning off the actual sound of the video game and then putting on music and creating like a score to it. And I mean, it really 100%. Does kind of like, it affects you in some weird, like, you know, audio visual way. So you're listening to new metal, you're listening to Slipknot, you're listening to all that shit. And then Moby suddenly comes in, because I would always assume that you, from the music that I've heard you make, it's very like, you know, it's like almost psychedelic, trip hoppy, new wave. I mean, you're kind of like, you're closer to Moby than you are closer to Slipknot.
It just took me a really long roundabout way to get there, I guess.
So how did that change? So you hear that, and then does that just kind of manifest into what? Like,
I was, as I was saying earlier, the list I was looking up of like sort of noteworthy records of that year, I can tell which ones I got from my friend's sister, because she also gave me Bukow Fish by Underworld. And I guess like 2 years before that, Prodigy put out The Fat of the Land, which I got from her as well. So like, it was sort of, I think the through line of these records is that they're sort of, they're based in rock almost, but then they make electronic, these people make electronic music, but they came from sort of like, you know, rock and sort of more instrumental music.
Yeah.
So I think I just ended up in this space because it was sort of like an easy slide into electronics with these records, like the Becks of the world and this Moby record as well.
Yeah, it was a really good point you just made. So, you know, this came out in 1999. This is like, I started going to raves, I think November of 1998 is and I was full on Wu-Tang, I was full on grunge, I was full rock music. And this guy, Tad Cavanaugh, no bullshit, being that you're from the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. My first rave experience was when I was in Amsterdam. I was in Amsterdam for about a month because I backpacked through Europe for about 7.5. And me and my buddy Joel, it was the first place I took ecstasy.
Yep.
And we went to some underground rave like right outside of the red light district off of like not Liedenspleen, or is that how you say it?
the Waterlooplein.
Is that how you say it? Leidseplein?
Leidseplein.
There it is.
Leidseplein. Yep.
So I go to, so we're like in that area, we go to this rave, I take ecstasy for the first time and I hear techno music, and it didn't really connect with me. I remember I was just like, I get back to the States and I'm like, man, all I want to do is just take ecstasy and just hook up with girls. I'm 18, 19 years old. Is like, I feel indestructible. Like nothing could stop me. You never think you're going to die. And so I started going to raves, and I remember listening to dance music and just kind of being like, it's not really my thing. Then I found drum and bass.
Oh yeah.
Which to me was more like the hard rock version of dance music. But so Moby really never made his way into my like stratosphere ever. But you made a good point, and that's what I wanted to get to. I'm sorry, I'm rambling. You made a good point, is that Prodigy kind of came out, and I remember my buddy who was a military dude in the Navy or the Air Force. He was in Europe. He was the reason we went to Europe, because he was like, if you go to Europe, you'll get laid. And you know, you're 18 years old, you only had sex with one girl, you know, you're like, oh my God, really? And
I'm I remember 9 hours for that.
Oh my God. Yeah. I was like, and we can drink on the airplane. Are you kidding me? So I remember talking to him because he was the one that brought me Radiohead, OK Computer. I had known Radiohead, but I had never listened to OK Computer. And then it was, I remember I asked him like, what else was big? And he was like, dude, the biggest band in Europe is Prodigy.
Oh yeah.
Prodigy was, I mean, you're talking stadiums. What was that like? What was that like? I mean, did you notice that being in, cause you're, I mean, you grew up in one of like, in like basically the upper center. No, I guess Germany's center, but like, you know, Netherlands is kind of like an amalgamation from what I know of like almost every culture. There's everybody there in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. Like, what is that like? Like, what is the music like in that scene? I mean, you tell me.
I mean, the Netherlands has always celebrated electronic music to like a crazy degree. And a lot of genres got like founded there too. And they still, up to this day, they rave like nobody else. It's just, it's wild. And yeah, like the Prodigy thing, definitely, you could see it taking over. And then everyone started sounding like it. And it sort of carved a way for, you know, I think Chemical Brothers were, I think, the first band to ever get a record on the radio that didn't have vocals on European radio, on like big radio, because that wasn't a thing. And they couldn't, I think they were even like snubbed with some like awards because they were just like, it didn't have the right elements that a pop song would have to have. It still was on number one, you know? So like, it was wild to live in a country that celebrated electronic music so heavily and like in such a mainstream way, even though a lot of countries are just like, this is an underground rave thing that this, it's not gonna rise to the top, you know?
Yeah.
It was wild, but yeah, even to this day, it's just electronic music is so massive in the Netherlands. It still outperforms anything. And I think it's just because they have the best drugs.
All they're doing is drugs and fucking, dude. Yeah. That's it. They're making wooden shoes. That's what you guys do. That's what you guys do better than anybody.
And making wooden shoes is clearly something that got done the first time on a truck, for sure. Like, check this shit out.
Yeah, let me walk.
Fuck your laces.
He's like, I bet you can't walk in this log. All right, you don't think so? You don't think I can walk in this log? Give me 8 hours. I'm gonna walk my ass off in this log.
Hey everyone, this is Tuck from Fit for a King, an off-road minivan. Every week I bring you fun interviews alongside your favorite metalcore entertainers with my new podcast, Get Tucked. Join me every Monday with bands like Counterparts, Crystal Lake, like Moths to Flames, and many more. We play unsigned and undiscovered bands, deep dive into each artist's history, and of course provide the greatest breakdowns in current metalcore. Tune in to Get Tucked every Monday, out now through Sound Talent Media.
Porn, Satan, drugs, therapy. It's not just the list of what I'm up to this weekend. I'm comedian Kiki Anderson, and those are just a handful of the taboo topics I've poked and prodded at so far on my podcast, Indecent, the show where we peel at the wallpaper of polite society. Each episode digs into the dark underbelly of our culture to dissect the things we aren't allowed to talk about around the dinner table, featuring conversations with comedians, activists, journalists, academics. They all help me figure out the who, what, and why behind what is and isn't acceptable behavior. Indecent with Kiki Anderson, where NSFW meets LMAO. Mwah.
Yeah, there's something about Europe that they appreciate music a little bit more than I think the Americans do. I think the Americans, we just go with the pop shit. We go with whatever's big, whatever's catchy, you know, whereas Gangnam Style was probably big around the world. It was massive here, you know, and it's just because it's catchy.
I haven't thought about that one in a while.
Electronic music. Oh, I think about it every day. I think about
your alarm.
I just like sleeping and at like 8:30 in the morning, just whoop, I'm Gangnam Style. And I get up and I'm like,
I do try to picture you like that, to be honest.
Dude, that's how I wake up, bro. That's my vibe. But yeah, the electronic music is big here now because of the rave scene and the way that the clubs have, you know, in the festivals have kind of. Pop music has marketed itself into like an electronic fashion, but there's something about Europe that, like I said, rock. I've said it a million times in the podcast, man. I remember when I went to a Tower Records in America and a Tower or a Virgin Megastore in England, and the bands that were advertised in America compared to the ones that were advertised in England were like night and day. One's pop and then one's Jack White Raconteurs. So you hear Moby in that girl's room. What kind of an impact does it have on you? Does that change the face of your musical direction immediately?
Yeah, I think so. I basically, with her, she just gave me stacks of CDs to take home in my backpack and then bring back at a later date. And I tried to do the same, not as successful. She had better taste than me.
Yeah.
But you know, she introduced me to Jamiroquai and Beck and like sort of weirder things of the same era that just expanded my mind and made me sort of appreciate a lot more different music. Funny thing is that at some point I was the sister, she was the sister of the bass player of our Shitty Little Garage Band. And the singer at some point randomly broke the news. Hey, you know that Nick is always going to your sister's bedroom? And we were holding our instruments. He like threw his bass down, ran to the sidewalk and threw up, which I think is such an amazing reaction to have to like my one of my best friends is like messing around with my sister. Hans, if you're listening, I'm very sorry.
Of course, his name is Hans.
Yeah, of course. Oh man, did I just say that? Yes, his name is Hans. Of course.
Did you guys fight?
He didn't speak to me for a week and then we kind of just slowly started playing music again. And he used to stand on one side of the drum set and then he stood on the other side from then on. Yeah. We were never the same.
No, that'll put a wedge between you guys for sure.
But you know, she taught me how to French, so that was decent.
God bless her. God bless her soul. Mm-hmm. And Hans. Sorry, dude.
Sorry,
Hans. Hans Gruber. That's every time you say Hans, I immediately think of the bad guy from Die Hard. I can't help it.
That's how he became the bad guy because that's
his origin story. His origin story. I love it. Yeah, man. You keep mentioning these bands that are really influential in my life, like you know, like Beck. I mean, you know, the late '90s. I mean, it was an interesting time for music. You know, we talked about this on the podcast before, Nick, about how the death of Kurt Cobain set this course of music that just changed everything. Whereas rock and roll became more, you know, like more male driven, more like aggressive. That's where you get the Korn, you get Limp Bizkit, you get like System of a Down. Bands like that, even though System of a Down is still kind of very political, they're more like Rage. But and then like you know, you have Beck that is coming off of Mellow Gold, and then he does Mutations, and then he does this groundbreaking record with Odelay, which is, you know, combining in a sense hip hop. Would you guys say electronic too? Like, I mean,
yeah,
I don't
mean, there's a ton of synths on there.
Ton of synths, but it's not dance music. It's closer to hip hop than it's closer to dance.
Yeah. Well, and then in 1999, he put out Midnight Vultures, which is my favorite Beck record. And it's also just like, that was the one where everything, Odelay was sort of like a setup, I feel, to the craziness of Midnight Vultures. And like, that record is full of genres. It's like, it has funk on it. It has jazz, soul, it has hip hop, it has grunge weirdly woven into it. It's It's a wild record.
We're my dogs.
Yeah. Hollywood freaks with the Hollywood scene. I mean, that album might have the greatest opening lyric to a song ever. It's like hot milk. Tweak my nipple.
Yeah.
That's how you go triple. I fucking
get into
love
my Honda.
Dude, that record was a big deal because that was like, you know, when I started going to the rave scene and that album was like kind of coming out. And I already at that point loved Odelay. I loved Mutations. So when that came out, that was a big record for me. And it was something that you could play at like a rave after party and people, cause it was so techno. It was so dance music. But Beck was something that was like, he was cool, man. And Beck still to this day remains cool. Speaking of which, I should tell this story because it's fucking dope. I went to go see Beck at Irving Plaza a week ago, last Wednesday, and my buddy Alex Edelman opened for him. And I had bought a ticket, but Alex did stand up. And then Alex knew I was there, so he invited me up to the VIP area to watch. And then afterwards, me, Alex, and these two other comics, we go to the after party. I get to, my buddy Sean Lennon is there, my homie Sean Lennon. Because I'm on the Lennon Claypool Delirium. I went up to him, we're talking.
Really?
Yeah, I did voiceover for it.
That's amazing.
Long story, but oh dude, I think like track like 8 on the record. There's these me and Sean met at a party, my friend Tall had, and we were jamming and he liked my voice. I was singing, he was playing guitar and stuff, and then he's like, hey man, he's like, do you do voiceover? I was like, yeah. And he's like, dude, I've got this track with Les Claypool that we just need voiceover. We don't even know if we're going to use it, but it's these weird, like, you know, what do they call? Not symptoms, but when you take medication, what could happen to you? What are they called?
I know what you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking about. Yeah, it's like side effects. Side effects. And that's what it's called. And he goes, it's just really weird shit. He goes, I don't know if we're going to use it, but if you want to give a stab at it, you know, go ahead. And I was like, yeah, dude. And he sent it to me. And I went to my VO department at William Morris and I recorded it. I sent it off. And then 9 months later on John Lennon's death anniversary, I texted Sean and I was like, hey man, just thinking of you today. And he goes, oh my God, Josh, dude, you know, thank you. But also we used your voice on the record. You're credited and everything.
Incredible.
So when I saw him at the Beck show, it was just, he's such a fun dude. And then we're all hanging out. And then later that night, you know, there's a lot of people of influence there, but I'm like making my way towards Beck, kind of talking to this girl. And then Beck actually comes up to me and the girl, and I get like 15 minutes to talk to him. And it was cool because it wasn't like as a fan, it was like, it was just like, oh, you're friends with my friends, so we're cool. And was such a huge fan of his. So,
I'm a massive Beck fan for sure.
So Beck, you know, the Prodigy came its way in there, but Moby, I feel like we got to focus on Moby because that's the fucking record we're talking about. Like, so Moby never really made its way into the music that I really, really dug. I like certain songs by them, you know, like the one I was listening to as we were signing on, the song from the movie Heat. I think it's called God Moving Over Water or something. I love that. I remember when Natural Blues came out and being like, okay, you know, this is catchy. What stuck out for you about this album that attracted you to it?
Yeah, I mean, I now know that like most of the samples on that record are field recordings of Alan Lomax. So they're like old traditional songs that are put together. I think it's like a 7-disc, like, compilation set of old traditional songs, and I don't know, that sound, I just hadn't heard it before, especially growing up in a small town in the Netherlands. Just it was so outlandish and weird. And I ended up seeing him live maybe like a year later, kind of right after that record, and that the show was just so good. I didn't expect it to be that good. He had probably like a 12-piece band that had a lot of singers like singing the samples live.
Yeah.
And he was way more outgoing and running around than I thought he would be. It wasn't a DJ set. It was like a full live show. And I think that was like the real impact. I think if you listen to this record, it's kind of weird. Revisiting this record was kind of crazy because I didn't remember it to be as long as it is, 18 songs long.
It's long.
And it's almost like half of it is a sort of weird dance record with samples on it and some of his vocals. And then the other half is like ambient, almost like 80s softcore porn, like soundtracks.
Yeah.
And so like, it's almost like they could have been two separate records. One with a bouquet of flowers on the front and the other one, the play record.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even clock that. I don't think that is something that stuck with me, but listening back to it, I'm like, half of this is just weird ambient stuff. And the other half is like pop songs almost.
Yeah. I mean, what do you got for us, Adam? Play was particularly notable for its use of samples and field recordings collected by Alan Lomax and compiled on the 1993 box set Sounds of the South, a musical journey from the Georgia Sea Islands to the Mississippi Delta. I don't know if I want to give my review just yet, but I feel like I should. All right, everybody. I think we finally got it. I think we finally got a record on this list that I don't think deserves to be on the 500 greatest albums list. I'm not saying it's a bad record. I'm not saying it's bad. What I'm saying is exactly what you just said. The songs on this record that are good are really good.
Mm.
And then you've got a bunch of filler. Like you said.
I'm willing to... We talked about this when we last walked together somewhere. We talked about like the fact that they might not be the best records ever made on this list, and some of them might just be the amount of influence they had. I think that a lot of European electronic music started taking a lot of notes from his sampling. And I think even in hip hop, even in like a lot of different genres, like there was like, I think there's some stuff that he did that I think didn't happen before in terms of like, the juxtaposition between sounds is so on the good songs, on the big songs, on the songs with the Alan Lomax samples. I think that particular way of like these old Southern songs with his like breadstick, like white dude like production on top of it, because it's like it's always because it's not his production is not funky or anything. It's not sort of favoring the samples almost. They stick out like a sore thumb, but it kind of works because of that. If he was more musical and more interested in matching it perfectly, I think it wouldn't work. And I think that's why some of these songs are really good, because it's just like kind of awkward the way he samples and the way it sticks out. So I think it's more like what ended up happening in Europe potentially with like electronic music taking notes.
Yes, completely. I can totally see how this record influenced, you know, millions of producers and you know, in electronic music. I don't know if I'm right or I'm wrong, Adam, on this. You might want to check if samples were that heavy in dance music. But I feel like he took one, like the big song on this, because there's eight singles.
Right.
There's eight singles, which is a lot. Some bigger than others. But there's eight singles off this record that were released, and you know, and then there's 10 other songs that, you know, can just probably be thrown out. I almost feel like if you just had those eight songs,
it would have been a better record.
It would have been a perfect 100%. Album. Yeah. Then you've got like a record that I'm like, oh, I get it. Like they weren't sampling like this prior to this record.
No, I'm not saying that like records weren't being sampled. I mean, the 80s hip hop era was obviously like sampling a lot of incredible stuff. What sticks out to me is the fact that like almost every sample is from that Alan Lomax compilation set. So it's like more like the tone that it sets on the entire thing is interesting. And like up to that point, I don't think Moby was doing really that interesting. His music wasn't that interesting to me, at least. And I think this sort of like broke him through because it was so juxtaposition was so crazy. I think that might be the bigger thing.
Here, let's find out a little bit about Moby, and then we'll find out about the making of this record. All right, so Moby, his real name is Richard Melville Hall, born in New York City in 1965. He takes up guitar and piano at the age of 9, played in a few underground punk bands during the 80s while DJing at clubs. In 89, he makes his change to EDM. 91, releases a single, Go. It was his first mainstream breakthrough. He had 8 top 10 hits on the Billboard dance charts from 92 to 97. Why don't I know any of them? During this time, he released 4 records, the self-titled Moby in 92, Ambient in 93, Everything is Wrong in 95, and Animal Rights in 96. And then that leads us to today's record. From 87 to 95, Moby has described his life as a very clean one, and he abstained from drugs, alcohol, and for the most part, sex. Okay. After taking LSD once at 19, he started to suffer from panic attacks, and he continued to experience but learned to deal with them more effectively. His mom dies of lung cancer in 97. He calls that an epiphany and experimented with alcohol, drugs, and sex. Finally, finally.
And he continued back into
loud sex. Fine,
I would say the same thing.
Fuck you. Fine, I'll fuck you. Okay. I'm experimenting. He did that for 4 years after his commercial success of Play. He is, you know, created an updated version of the James Bond theme for Tomorrow Never Dies. He had music in Scream. He had a cover of New Dawn Fades by Joy Division. And the song I talked about, the instrumental version of what appeared in Heat. He's a huge vegan, huge supporter of animal rights. He also owns a vegan cafe on both coasts. And a vegan music and food festival called Circle V. So this album clocks in at an hour and 2 minutes and 37 seconds. This is his fifth studio record. Came out May of 1999 in the UK and June 99 in the US. Previous record, Animal Rights, deviated from his usual electronic style. It was darker and more guitar-based. It was such a flop commercially and critically, especially among the fans, Moby considered walking away from music. He explained, and this is weird. I can't believe you found this, Adam. I was opening for Soundgarden.
Okay.
Okay. And getting shit thrown at me every night on stage. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I did my own tour and was playing to roughly 50 people a night. However, positive reactions to Animal Rights from fellow artists such as Axl Rose and Bono inspired Moby to continue producing music. He got back to work in his Little Italy, New York studio to work on Play in the mid-97, but had to put it on hold several times to complete touring obligations. After multiple mixes were done, he finally settled on the final one in March 99. He thought this would be his last record. His American label, Elektra, dropped him after Animal Rights bombed, so he had to shop the album around to various labels before V2 picked it up. He faced an uphill battle, as many journalists wouldn't even listen to the album to review it. The first show he played in support of Play at the basement of the Virgin Megastore in Union Square was attended by only 40 people, further damaging the album's commercial prospects. The songs received little airplay from radio stations on or MTV VH1. Management decided to try licensing the songs for use in films, commercials, and TV shows to spark some interest. And by the beginning of 2000, it had worked. It slowly climbed up the charts and remained there for all of the year 2000, gaining the legacy that has us talking about it today. It peaked at number one on the UK albums and UK independent album charts, 38th on the Billboard 200, number one in Australia, France, Ireland, New Zealand, Scotland, top five in a few other countries. It's certified platinum in more than 20 countries and with over 12 million copies sold worldwide. It's 2 million in the US. It's the biggest selling electronic album of all time. Wow.
What it says.
That is what it says. Good for you, Moby. Moby's noted that he intentionally sequenced the album such that it starts off energetic and then by the end dissolves into an opiated haze. Okay. So then that makes sense of why the record kind of turns that way. So besides the samples, you know, What sticks out for you about this record? Like what are the things that you enjoy most about this?
I think just hearing all of that, like hearing how it came about, it's kind of funny because I think if he would have decided to put one of the ambient songs up front, this record wouldn't have come out. I don't think so. You know what I mean? Like if somebody had to just listen to one of the cuts that are just like not as as rambunctious, but luckily it starts with, I forget the name of the song. I can look it up, but
Honey. Honey's yeah. Catchy. Yeah, Honey's catchy.
It's a great start. I think if that wouldn't have been the case, I don't think I would have been into this record. And again, like the thing that sticks out most thinking back to it, honestly, is that live show. Because it really, I think it was... it was the same, like it was a festival in the Netherlands that the headliners that year were Massive Attack, Faithless. I don't know if you're familiar with them, and Moby, and all three shows were just full band shows of electronic acts. And I think that that is the biggest stamp that I took away from it in hindsight. Yeah.
I mean, it's hearing that it took a while for this to gain traction. For me, I mean, it kind of, when this really got big, it felt like it was everywhere. It was all over the radio. It was all in movies. It blows my mind that it took a while. Does that surprise you that it took a while to catch on?
I mean, not really, because even the big songs, I think you still have to hear them quite a few times before they just really stick. I think especially in like a sort of like in a bigger way, like a pop consciousness. I'm not 100% surprised that this record would take a while to just catch on, because there was just not really anything that sounded like it. I think that's also why I said like earlier about like the significance of this record. I think is because I don't think there was something like this really in that particular sound.
No, I get that. I definitely get that, because you know, looking back now, it's like I just remember looking at the singles, like Honey, I didn't hear till later. Run On, I didn't hear until after 99. Body Rock, I remember when that came out.
Yeah.
There were a lot of songs, Body Rock, like the Beastie Boys had a Body Rock song. Mm-hmm. Why Does My Heart Feel So Bad? I never heard that on the radio. I don't think the first song I heard from this record that was played really, and then I started hearing a lot of the other singles after that, was Natural Blues. That was like an iconic. If you say what is the most 1999 sounding song of all time, if I hear that, it immediately takes me back to the year 99, to the year 2000. Porcelain, which the first time I think I heard that was in the soundtrack to The Beach. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
that was
that
was the Leonardo DiCaprio movie he did after Titanic. It was a big deal. Yeah, I saw it in the theater, bro. It was Danny Boyle. Southside, I just remember because of how gorgeous Gwen Stefani was in the music video.
Mm-hmm. It was also a very, very music video heavy record. I remember a lot of this from like watching MTV a lot and then seeing these videos, because his videos were always very good, especially for this record.
What was the video for Natural Blues again? Was it like, can you pull it up for a second, Adam? Pull up the video for Natural Blues. Because if I remember correctly, I think it's like...
Oh, that's just a good one.
Christina Ricci's in it?
Yeah.
So right now, if anybody's not, they're not seeing this, it's just a bunch of elderly people, Moby being one of them, with a lot of makeup on. He's picked up a book that's got his name on it. And it's a lot of pictures of him as a younger vegan. Get to Christina. There she is. God, I have the biggest crush on her. Owen Benjamin used to date her, and he used to bring her to the Hollywood Improv. And I was like in shock. And now Owen Benjamin is a right-wing militant comedian that people think is going to start another Ruby Ridge. Swear to God. That's that thing that happened in like I'm gonna fuck it up, like Iowa or somewhere, that like where they attacked the cops, or it's a whole thing. There was a good documentary on it in Netflix. But Owen Benjamin, former comic, now right-wing militant, he was engaged to her. He was engaged to Christina Ricci.
Classic move.
I mean, that's a great song. Classic.
One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget, and we decide if they brought the One Hit Thunder or were nothing more than a one hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week. So pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods.
Hello out there.
Yes, hello out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hayden, Backstreet's Magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Menahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!
So there's 8 singles from this record. What's your personal favorite?
I think that one is sort of the most memorable one to me. And I love I would say that's but like Body Rock was like was a great, like the live version of that, like when I went to go see it, that was fantastic. But I think that song still is like the most iconic cut from the whole record. That's it.
So looking up, let's look up a little bit about Natural Blues. I can't believe this was the 5th single released from the record. This track features vocal hooks sampled from the Vera Hall song Trouble So Hard. It peaked at number 11 on the UK singles charts. In Iceland, it peaked at number 1. Moby said, of all the successful singles on the record, Natural Blues is my favorite. It's quite ethereal and mournful. It almost didn't make it on the record. Really? I had some friends over and I was playing them some songs off the record and they thought it was too weird. I couldn't get it. I mean,
just get rid of some of the ambient shit. Like, don't put the big single on your record, brother.
That's the shit. They were probably like, yeah, dude, this like song that just is a repeat of the same thing for the last 3.5 minutes.
I don't think they wanted him to make it.
Keep this on the record. They said they didn't like the mix of it.
They were afraid that if he put that song on the record that he would start fucking again.
I mean you can fuck to this song. I mean, you know, it's just you know, you're gonna,
especially if you're vegan.
It's just gonna be weird. It's just, this is not like there's some good songs to fuck to on this record, which we'll get to. So like this sticks out to me, Honey sticks out to me, Rushing, if I'm not mistaken, because my big like entrance into EDM, where I was like, okay, now I'm at raves, I should really start listening to electronic dance music. I got a CD, MTV2 used to put out a CD called Amp. Do you guys remember Amp?
Oh yeah.
And I had Amp 2, the second one.
Oh, there's some great stuff on there.
All right. So looking at this list is kind of like, this is all stuff that you can lump Moby into. Fatboy Slim. I can't believe we've gone almost 45 minutes into the podcast and we haven't mentioned Fatboy Slim.
Especially that song.
Fatboy Slim, Rockefeller Skank. I mean, that like swept MTV. It was fucking everywhere on the radio. How different is this from Fatboy Slim? Let's talk about that.
I mean, Fatboy Slim, I would say, is way heavier to me, like in general. Like the drums have always been way heavier, and like the sort of angry hip hop boom bap that's under a lot of the tracks.
Yeah.
And I think, because like it's almost like Moby came from a rock background, like being a guitarist, pianist, like playing in like punk bands and that kind of stuff, and then going to electronic music. And I think Fatboy Slim potentially comes in, I think would come from way darker electronics and then went more pop with it. I think he's like a rave guy that went pop.
But why are we talking about this record and not talking about Fatboy Slim's record? Because I remember the Fatboy Slim record, you know, it's using samples. It's basically doing the exact same shit that Moby's doing. And I think it was just as big. If I'm not mistaken, Fatboy Slim was like the headliner at like Nebworth.
But for sure, the question is the Rolling Stones list mostly created by Americans, or is it pretty 50-50?
It's all over the place. It has nothing to do with America. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I would say that Fatboy Slim didn't really get the attention that he deserved in the U.S. And like it was more of a European UK thing, I think. I mean, apart from if you're talking like maybe like MTV2, but in Europe it was MTV1. You know what I mean? Like the songs were massive.
I remember Fatboy Slim playing the MTV Music Awards. If I'm not mistaken, he played the Grammys. Because his music videos, I felt, were a little bit more iconic than the Moby videos. I thought the Moby video we just watched was totally different than the one that we actually just saw. I thought it was going to be, I just remember it totally different. I remember like the Fatboy Slim stuff, you know, you have, what was the one? He has the one with, not Rockefeller Skank, the other one where he's got, Christopher Walken. Those are some of the biggest. That's some of the biggest shit. Yeah, those are incredible. Oh, yeah. And not knocking.
And we haven't talked about, like, you know, Chemical Brothers in that matter, and like Basement Jacks, and like there's a lot of acts that I would, you know, also love to talk about in that case for sure. I think it was just a very good time for electronic music that was kind of sample heavy and like. But yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think the Basement Jacks videos were insane, and the songs that accompanied them were wild.
See, my first experience with Basement Jacks is Where's Your Head At? I mean, that was, I think that came out in like 2003, maybe.
Also that video.
Video is incredible. You know, I mean, looking at this MTV2 thing, I mean, this CD, I mean, Battle Flag by Low Fidelity All-Stars, that's been in so many movies. I said hallelujah, until the 16 blow your bends up. That one fucking ruled. What else did I love?
Look at the most 1998 thing of all time. Sexy Boy by Air, mixed by Beck.
Yeah,
mixed
dude.
By Beck.
Now, I remember that, man.
That's a 90s sandwich right there.
That Air had a moment, man. Air definitely had a moment. Genius by Pitch Shifter, Circles by Adam F. Dude, my shit was Brown Paper Bag by Ronnie Size. Like, I... For a long time, dude, I used to put on I used to put on New Forms anytime I had sex with a girl while I was in college. It's like perfect, like fucking music, just like real ambient drum and bass. That album, New Forms, by Ronnie Size, actually won the American Music Prize in 1997, which beat out, if I'm not mistaken, it beat out Radiohead, OK Computer. And it beat out Massive Attack, Mezzanine, which is insane. But that's also because that record was so different. It was so new. Drum and bass was really taking off. I mean, what awards do you have that listed, Adam? Like, what awards this record won?
I can pull it up in a second. It's kind of scattered throughout, but I'll get it in a second.
Okay. While I ask you that, while he looks that up, let me ask you this. Because you are a musician as well, you make incredible music, and your art is just incredible. Like, does the music you listen to influence the art that you're making?
Definitely. I mean, when it comes to the album covers that I made, I would listen to the band even if I didn't necessarily love the band, over and over, just to like have it seep into the art, and always has to be a part of it. And I listen to either music or books all day long while I draw. So definitely it has to sort of coincide and completely changes my mood and what I do, for sure.
So when you, because I don't know if everybody that knows this, you actually made the Foster the People album cover for like their big, big hit.
10 years
like,
ago.
Yeah, you told me that story. Would you tell my listeners, like, it's such an interesting story about how that happened.
Yeah, so when I was living with my parents, parents' house, I used to make a ton of like art for like my friends' bands or just bands that I loved, and I would just send it to them because it was like sort of it's the middle of the MySpace era where the idea of like emailing or getting in touch with a band just really got kicked up a notch, you know. You're kind of able to get in touch with most people, and I just started making art for, like, at that time my favorite band, The Velveteen, out of Petaluma, California. And they were managed by this guy, John, and he got in touch with me. He's like, hey, I love what you did for you know, our band. And there's this kid that I work with, and he's your age. And at that time I must have been like 17. And the kid was Mark Foster. And I started just sending him art for his MySpace. I got pretty decent at customizing MySpace pages. To sound ancient, but I would just make him flyers. I'd make him CDs that he would like put his demos on, that he would just go to like little labels too and everything. And then at some point I kind of lost touch with him for a bit. And then a year later he came back and said, Nick, I think I wrote a hit. I'm like, all right, send it to me. And he sent me this demo and it was a hit. I heard it. I'm like, this is your biggest song. This is crazy. Like, this is definitely really good. And he's like, yeah, I played it for some people. And I think I'm about to get signed. And, you know, you always did my art for free. You always like, you know, helped me out with this stuff. I'll finally be able to pay you. Like, I'm making a record. And the song was Pumped Up Kicks. And
which was huge, dude. That song was
number one everywhere. Though.
Everywhere.
Like, and it's also in a time that indie songs that sort were not getting looks like that. It was the types of bands that would make that kind of music that you get number ones. They got an interesting look maybe on like a mid-sized festival or like something like that. But it was crazy to see that happen in front of me. And he, you know, I still make art with him. And we always stay friends. And that was, yeah, it was wild to see someone legitimately blow up in front of you.
Which is so cool. And I mean, to be able, because it's almost like when you're working as an artist, you know, we all have egos, but you almost have to like suppress it just to make the art and just put it out there and just be like, listen, it's like, I appreciate what you're doing. I want to work with you and your music inspires me or whatever. And so you keep coming back to that. And from what I've been reading is that Moby is basically very humble. He has a very like, you know, very low ego, despite all this massive success that he had, which right now, and even with you, being that you're having this great moment with NFTs and with your artwork and people, I see these huge comics that are working with you now. And you know, what role does ego play when it comes to your creativity?
The best thing about what I do is that if I'd get a big ego about it, people would be very confused because there's no way to place my ego. You know, if you have a ton of people listening to you and you're going to award shows and you're doing that stuff, I think it's way harder to curb your ego, especially if everyone says like, I love you, you're incredible. I don't really get that. I'm just like making art and it's almost the only reaction I get is like on Instagram. It's wonderful to talk to people. And like, it's amazing that the people that listen to Foster People get tattoos all over their body of like the drawings that I make. That shit's incredible. But there's almost like, I don't have a public forum to gloat, you know? So it's like, I don't know if I would otherwise, but like my successes are so behind screens and behind doors that it's just kind of, I can brag to a friend, but you know, it doesn't have the same impact as like big platform to say all that stuff. I personally don't think I have a big ego. I think there was a moment when I was trying to make music and try to make it in music and little successes came. I think there was a little moment where I could see myself getting an ego, but luckily I never got big.
Yeah.
Thank God for staying indie. I don't think there's a big, I see people that have big egos in art, especially like now in the NFT space. And I tried to sell paintings at some point and I realized that the normal traditional art world is not for me.
Yeah.
It's insane. I don't think I would fare well in it.
Well, I mean, even with Moby, it's like you know, the guy starts doing this, you know, he does punk rock. He moves on from that. He starts working on the electronic music. He's moving on from that. And then he starts doing this record, you know, and I mean, to imagine like people are like shitting on it. Like, let's look at some of the album reviews from this record. All right. So here's some of the nice ones. So according to Spin Magazine, Will Hermes, Play was the high water mark for populist electronica and a millennial roots and blues masterwork. John Bush from AllMusic said it balanced Moby's early electronica sound with the emergent breakbeat style of techno. And Chicago Sun-Times critic Jim DeRogatis noted its incorporation of such disparate musical influences as early blues, African American folk music, gospel, hip hop, disco, and techno, all within the context of his own distinctly melodic ambient stylings. All right, so there you go. You have the good ones. And for the most part, you know, yeah, I agree with that. Here are some of the bad ones. And I love that we do the bad ones, Adam. Pitchfork reviewer Brent DiCrescenzo believed the raw magnetism of the sampled recordings was lost to innate digital recording techniques, resulting in music that was fun and functional yet disposable. Thoughts on both of those sets of reviews? Nick, what do you think?
I mean, I get the Pitchfork guy's point of like the fact that the samples were recorded with analog old gear in an older time, sort of offset it to what, I mean, because if you listen to like the keyboard sounds on this record, they're pretty terrible. Yeah. I don't know what kind of synthesizer he was using, but they're like, they're very pastiche and like very cliche. And I like in this sort of 90s kind of way, it kind of is endearing to me, but I understand that the guy from Pitchfork is like, yeah, this sounds, that's what I'm saying. Like the record is disheveled. It's like, he's so white that,
yeah,
I mean, he's like old samples, like offset to it. It is uncomfortable. I like it because of it, but like, I completely understand if someone's like, wow, this does not work.
Wow. That, I love what you just said right there. Yes. Like that's, cause that's my next question is, does this hold up? Does this album hold up fucking 22 years later?
Some of it.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I've recently been on a kick of like, you know, I think we're all in a more nostalgic mood than ever before because of, you know, sort of time we're in. I think I see it across the board. I think a lot of people now call it nostalgia, but because you're looking back such a short period of time. But I'm looking at what record holds up, and like especially from those eras, there's not a whole lot that holds up just because of the recording technique. It's like, it's almost like the time of recording, like 70s recording are all beautiful because of the material they were using. 80s recording, I personally am not a big 80s guy because I don't like all the gated reverbs on all the drums and I'm not a big reverb guy. I like things to be small and sort of together. But then the 90s is kind of, in a way, one of the worst periods because unless like the producer was using old gear, like, you know, like a Steve Albini was using like all the 70s gear to record 90s bands. And that's why those records sound fucking fantastic.
Yeah.
But a lot of the 90s stuff, like, oh, you don't need all this big stuff anymore. Let's be like, you only need this, like a small computer, small desk, one keyboard and like this thing, and you can just have a studio in your house. And like, we weren't there yet. So like all those records just sound pretty bad. Does it hold up? I think the singles are still massive. I wouldn't mind hearing what he would do with it now. Like if he would re-record those songs, how that would sound with all the years of experience. But I mean, I think, does this record deserve to be on the list? I think influential, like how influential it was, yes, in terms of like that whole album. I listened to it a bunch the last couple of days. Like it could have used with 10 less tracks.
Yes, completely.
And like maybe 8 less because of like a full 10 in the track list, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But because like if the ambient songs in there were intermezzos that were shorter because they would like lean into something and like for a second to take you out of it and take you to the next one, it'd be fine. But they're just like full blown, like long, you know?
Yeah.
And they're just not as good.
No, they're not.
Because the ambient stuff all leans on his musicality, which at that time I don't think was amazing. You know, like I think the instinct of using these samples to make himself sound better were incredible.
Yeah. You said that perfectly. I mean, those 8 singles are great. They're great songs. Not all of them are as good as the other ones, dude. Like I got to give a shout out because I actually, the song that I was drawn to the most off of this record, and I think I've been drawn to more than any of them is Southside. I don't know why I love it so much. I love that chorus so fucking much. And they have a bridge in it that I love. I remember when it first came out, I didn't dig it as much, but as I listened to it on this go round, I was like, man, I really love this song. This is the one that I'm taking with me. You know, you said something about the influential. What artists do you think this record has influenced that are making music now? Or like, where do you see the big influences?
I mean, I think I would think about it more as a sort of like time capsule of that moment.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at like that time period of like the Basement Jaxxes, the Chemical Brothers and Fatboy Slims and Moby and all those people, I think that timestamp, I think, is what modern electronic music still borrows from each day. I think the disclosures of the world, like the whole American EDM scene sort of like still leans on a lot of stuff that I think all those guys like sort of carpeted.
Who is the guy that, who, not to cut you off, but who is the guy that passed away? Avicii?
Mm-hmm.
Avicii's last, was his last record where he was sampling like, you know, cowboy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just this record made so 20 years later.
He found
a different
compilation record.
Yeah. Yeah, he found a different thing to borrow the samples from. Adam, find the big song off that record, because I would love to hear a compare and contrast between that and like Natural Blues or even Honey or something. Somebody that says they were influenced by it is Adele. She name checks him on her records as saying that this one is one very really.
I don't see it.
I don't see a sense of connection between them at all.
I wish I could see it. I wish you took some notes. Would have been interesting to see that.
I mean, but, well, here you go. No, actually, I just, as you were saying that, it just popped in my head. I mean, Rolling in the Deep. I mean, that's kind of got a Natural Blues feel to it. Am I right or am I wrong?
I could see that. I'd have to place them next to each other, but I could see that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, listen, I'm pulling, you know, straws here, but.
Sure.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.
And then, you know, is it surprising to you that this was like, that Moby's a New Yorker, being that you've lived in New York for so long?
A little bit. I mean, like, having heard the story of like how he, like how he came to the record, to the El Nomex, the compilation record, makes a bit more sense, because it was just a friend of his that just like had this thing and said like, you have to hear this compilation. It's amazing. I bought it. But like Moby bought it and never gave it back. And it's like, you know, that's what he took from it. But I don't know if I would call this like full on a New York record or like a New York sounding record. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe some of the singles have like a bit more of a New York feel to them than others. But as a whole record together, I think of this more as an LA record.
Yes. Yeah, this is very LA. Could be
the fact that they was trying to stick the songs into movies makes a lot of sense to me, because they live perfectly, even the ambient stuff.
I mean, there's a lot of music that I'll listen to, and it's like, I think everybody kind of has like the sound, like they have like the movie that they want to make in their head, and like, so they'll hear a song, they're like, this is how I'm opening my movie. And then it's like, there's a lot of like,
what you would know, you open a, your movie?
I don't know what I'd open it with. I want to open a movie where these two guys are like going on this road, and the guy's like, here, pull over right here. And the guy runs up and he steals somebody's Amazon package. And then as he's like running to his car, and the guy whose package he just stole is running out of the house. And the shot is from inside the car facing out. Ramblin' Gamblin' Man by Bob Seger comes on. That like,
yeah.
And then I want to end a movie with Stardust by Nat King Cole. Very beautiful scene.
Ooh.
Like a friend says goodbye to his other friend. Because it's the thing that I actually am writing now, but it's like Stardust is in the last like 5-6 years has become top three, if not my favorite song of all time. I think it's one of the most beautiful songs ever written. It's so against, you know, if you looked at me, I don't think you would ever say that like, oh, I believe that Stardust is his favorite song ever. It's just...
I listened to a lot of Nat King Cole recently again. I have moments to come back to him.
That's music that, especially in our society, like, all right, so we just yesterday recorded Black Flag Damaged. And that was a hard listen for me to listen to when I wasn't at the gym. Do you know what I mean?
Just like, sitting down with Damage.
You cannot listen to that. You know, I can't get on the subway. I can't walk to a comedy club and just suddenly it's just like, you know, we got to rise above. We got to rise above. It's just
it's a great origami record. You just sit at home, just try to make a dragon or a goose. You know, that's what I use.
Yeah, like balloon animals. Like this record was a good record for me to listen to when I walked. You know, this the scene of New York, like what you said, this is an LA record. you know, I feel like you can listen to this on a walk. You can listen to this when you're chilling. There is like ambient shit that you can play in the background. You know, this is like dinner party music too. Like you're having friends over, everybody's kind of chilling. You're playing board game night. You could put this on in the background.
It's like when I'm walking around in New York, I want to listen to Prodigy. Like that's, I want anger and I want loudness and I want to shove people out of the way. And it's just like, and I mean, I think I could listen to the Damaged and then, you know, get on the train. I think I'd be fine with it.
All I want to listen to right now, and I sent you the clip of it. I don't know if I mentioned this at the beginning, but Damon Albarn has a new record that I think is the best album of 2021. I think it's the best album I've heard post-COVID. It's so beautiful. It's so fucking good. Never liked Blur. Gorillaz, I like some stuff by Gorillaz, but man, Damon's solo shit, in my opinion, I think it's better than anything he's ever done. Everyday Robots was brilliant. I still listen to it since 2014-15, but man, go out, this is to everybody, because I want to fucking, let me pull up the name of it. Go out and listen to The Nearer the Fountain, More Pure the Stream Flows. You're welcome. It's so good. All right, let's do some random facts. All right, so this is the last time we talk about Moby on the 500. And this album didn't make the cut for the Rolling Stone 500 2020 list. I am surprised about that, Adam.
I'm not, though. Because
why?
Because I feel like this album deserved to be on the 500 at the time it came out, because it was kind of, you know, like it was capturing what was becoming popular at the time. But you listen now, you know, in 2020, it's like, I see why it was popular at the time. But yeah, I don't think that belongs there now. No. But for that piece, for that era of time, absolutely, I see why it's there.
Yes. But dude, we just talked, Nick just said this and it makes sense. This has influenced every electronic dance song that's come out since.
True.
So
it's a legacy album then, more than.
Yeah, it should be on there. Fuck that. I don't like this record personally. I didn't hate it at all. So I'm going to get shit for this. I didn't hate this record. I just, like I said, the ambient songs could have been left off. This was usually, it's like, oh, if you cut these two songs, it's a perfect record. You have to cut 10 songs from this album to make this a perfect record. 10 fucking songs.
Have you heard a good 18 track record? I just can't find it. There's good records with 18 tracks, but I've never heard 18 good tracks by a band.
Hold up, dude. I'm about to fucking, I think I've got it.
Unless you're giving me like Speaker Box Love Below, but that's just two records, so it doesn't count.
Here we go. Hold on, wait. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Oh, it's 17. And I'm talking about Abbey Road. Abbey Road has 17 songs on it.
Fair.
One more. Oh, wait. Oh, no, Her Majesty. That's still 17. You're right. Yeah, 18 tracks is a lot of tracks.
Most bands have 10 good ones in them, and even at their highest time. I mean, I guess the Blood Sugar Sex Magik has like a crazy amount, but I think it's still reshaped out.
Yeah, I think you got to shave from this. You got to shave. Moby said he preferred the instrumental tracks from this album over the ones with vocal tracks.
Clearly, I mean, clearly,
he had 10 of them. Yeah, he had 10 of them.
I mean, also, he previously had made an ambient record. It's just like, why? I don't know. It's like it's like that record Drugs by Aphex Twin.
Yeah.
It has like it has a ton of really beautiful piano tracks, but they're all hustled in between the crazy electronic music. And I was always so upset that it just couldn't be a list. I mean, I understand why he did it, but still, it's a two-disc record. Make one of them the piano tracks and the other one the crazy acid stuff. So I can listen to it in like, and not feel like a psychopath. You know?
Yeah. No, I
never understood that.
All right, I found that Adele cited her influence. She said about when she released 25, there's something that I find really holy about the album Play, the way it makes me feel. Even though there's nothing holy or preachy about it, there's just something about it. Maybe it's the gospel samples, but it makes me feel alive. That album still, and I remember my mom having that record. All right. Yeah. I mean, she's 25 in 2015. She was a little girl when that came out. I could see this being like a really fun kids record, you know?
Yeah. It sounds magical. For sure.
Sounds magical. Adam, what do you got? You're looking at me. Did you find, didn't I ask you to look up something?
Avicii?
Yeah. Pull up the Avicii song.
Hey, brother.
I just love that this came from a like that this sample was chosen by a Swedish man. I found this like Ford dealership slogan. Oh, I got this great sample. You have to hear it. You know.
Oh, this is so good. I've been listening to the Hank Williams. I've been listening to the Waylon Jennings. It's so good. It's so good. Be careful sitting on that couch. It's made from IKEA. It will fall apart if you fart on it. Yeah, I mean, look, that song was a huge, huge hit. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, that's got over a billion streams on Spotify, man. And I mean, that is 100%. If you don't have Moby sampling these old black artists, I don't think he would even think about making a country western techno song. Moby opened the door for a lot of music to go into dance music. So for that, Mobes, big ups. All right, what do you got for me, Adam?
At Brian Hernandez writes that this was one of the best albums that he listened to in high school and that it was instrumental for him as growing up and it sparked his interest in electronic dance music.
Big ups, Brian Hernandez. Is that his name? Brian?
At Brian Hernandez.
Big ups, Brian Hernandez. Thank you for being a Patreon subscriber in the Fleece Army. All right, Nick, I love you so much. Rapid questions and then you are out of here. You ready for them?
Let's do it.
Are you ready?
Ready.
Favorite song on the record?
Oh, yeah, you're saying rapid. Honey.
Okay. Honey. I'm going to go with Southside. Least favorite song on the record?
Any of the ambient shit.
Any of the ambient? Which is the worst one, though?
I don't know. They're all just not as good as the main stuff.
I know.
Guitar, flute, and string.
Perfect. What song on this record would you fuck to?
Porcelain?
Yeah, dude. Porcelain's good. You can fuck to a lot of the songs on this album.
Yeah.
And last question. Why should the youth of this generation listen to this record?
To take a break off sex.
Good answer. Nick, I love you. Anything you want to promote? Everybody, I'm telling you, go follow at Young and Sick on all social media. Buy his art, listen to his music. Do you have anything you're working on right now you want to talk about?
No. No, I'm just drawing a bunch of random shit. Just keep looking at the Instagram, I guess.
Support any way you can. Nick, I love
Thank you. Love you.
What did I tell you? What did I tell you? The one and only Young and Sick, a.k.a. Nick Von Hefwegen. Follow Young and Sick on Instagram, at Young and Sick, on Twitter, at Young_and_sick. And for all things Nick, go to his website, youngandsick.com. For listener shout out this week, I want to give a shout out to Ryan Kitching. On Instagram, he's Unk on Shus. UNKONSHUS. You are a true Fleece Army. I love you to death. Thank you for listening. Thank you for liking. Thank you for everything. All right, new music this week. Brooklyn-based DJ, The Company Sound System, whose deep house sound owes quite a bit of shit to Moby. And you're listening to Pieces of Meat, Waiting for a Butcher, released through Three Bridges Records. And you can find all the links on our website, the500podcast.com. Send us your song, guys. I want to play it. Put it in an email to 500podcast@gmail.com. Next week, it's fucking Black Flag Week. And we're doing Damaged. It's from 1981. Listen to it.
creature like that.
the 500. Keeping it fleecy for the Fleece Nation. On the 500.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room.
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Frates from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective. The only podcast you crank up to 11.
Next Chapter Podcasts.